So, in chapter 21, Cross-Cultural Exchange, we see the proliferation of travel due to an increased technology expertise that allows travel to be easier, especially with the magnetic compass and the lateen sail. Also because of the legacy of the Mongolians, who have cleaned up the trade routes and facilitated an increased amount of trade, which that legacy carries on to post-Mongolian eras. So when the Mongolians decline, you see an increase from travelers from Europe and China, which would include Marco Polo and Ibn Battuta. So they are the vanguard that leads the way for these increased travels and trade that will be going on. Now, Marco Polo is going to conduct his business more as a merchant trader rather than a religious figure. Although he will be initiating and incorporating Christianity, he really is more of a merchant trader. And what's unique is that during the Mongolian time frame, he is actually going to serve as a governor for a province under Kublai Khan. It's kind of interesting because Kublai Khan himself would never really put a Chinese person in charge of a province because that person might build up that province and attack the Mongolians. So they're more likely to put a foreigner in charge of a province, and Marco Polo gains the support and trust of Kublai Khan, so therefore he gets that position. So therefore you're going to see a lot of Western influence start to flow into China. There will be Christian missionaries. The book talks about a guy called Monte Covino or something like that, who becomes the bishop of Tonbali. So the next one is Ibn Battuta, which is more of a religious figure that will traverse many territories within really Dar al-Islam. So he's not really on a missionary exploit, as more of a cleansing exploit. As he travels to territories that have Islam as a faith, he's there to ensure that the proper values are followed and that following the law of Sharia is going to be conducted properly, and that these people who live their lives of Islam know how to incorporate their relationships with the different sexes and what their roles are in society and how properly to behave. And so he will travel. He's going to be going to Mali. He'll be going to Mozambique. He will work for the Sultanate of Delhi, and he is a Qadi, who is a judge that will try all kinds of courts, and not try courts, but be like a trial lawyer to ensure that the law of Sharia is followed. And he'll give out punishments for people that do not follow Islamic law. And one essence that he has a difficult time in is in Africa, where animism has been blended with Islam. And that would include that they hold on to their culture, such as women being bare-breasted. That is something that Islam still fights today as it tries to clean up what Islam is, especially in Africa, to make sure people follow the rules properly. So, once again, both of them are out there in the world. They are bringing on their values and incorporating, really, the Eastern Hemisphere, in essence, into one big trading hemisphere. So we're talking about trade, we're talking about diplomacy, we're talking about the missionary impulse that pushes Muslims and Christians to wander out into the territory, and trading technological devices, especially like the magnetic compass and lateen sail. Okay, so trade cities. I just threw up some of the important cities up on the board I think you should know about. Cities such as Konbalik, Hangzhou, Huangzhou, Malacca, Cambay, Samarkand, Constantinople, Hormuz, Baghdad, and Venice. You could probably name some more, but these cities are famous for being clearinghouses and trade centers. The reason why is because they hold a strategic location on the map. They can control territories from those places. It's very influential. If you have a military there, they can project their influence out on the territory. If it's a religion, once again, they can project their influence out on the territory with the religion. And they have a strong political system that maintains order. As long as you have order in that environment, then it's safe to trade. If your political system is disrupted, and merchants can't trust the trade that's going back and forth, then no one's going to use that trade route. Therefore, that city will not be an important trade city. So maintaining order with a strong political system is important. And something that is still a problem today is resisting heavy taxation. An example of this is Denton Tap Road that runs right through Coppell, because the intent of that road is to bring many travelers through Coppell where they'll stop off and buy goods, therefore you tax them. However, if you tax them too much, which Coppell is on the verge of, then businesses can't operate and pay their property taxes, so they move to new territories. So resisting taxation is always going to be a political entity that you want to prevent. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, because the more you improve your political system, the larger it gets and the more people you have to hire to administer your political system. So it's a balancing act, which still goes on today. So therefore, let's talk about exchange. The magnetic compass is going to be moving from China all the way west until it gets to the Europeans. Although Arab traders will use it, it really is the European traders who maximize the potential of the compass, probably because they are near the Atlantic Ocean and no one has ventured out into the Atlantic Ocean, whereas Arab traders have operated in the Indian Ocean and in essence have exploited that Indian Ocean trade routes to its fullest potential with no necessary need to go any further. So the Europeans are going to take that the concept of the use of the magnetic compass further. Cotton is a trade commodity. It is not a food product. So whenever you plant cotton, or for that matter, sugarcane, you are going to be using ground dirt to raise something you can't eat. So although it is great for trade and for making money and profiteering and improving corporations, cotton and sugarcane are going to take up food territory, so to speak. And this isn't a big deal back then, but historically, as this grows, it will be what will disrupt and sometimes collapse societies. Now there's gunpowder. As you know, the Chinese invented gunpowder in about 900 AD. They didn't really maximize upon it. They kind of used some rockets and whatnot, but they're pretty much ineffective, sometimes used for psychological warfare to intimidate the enemy. The Mongolians did something really cool with it, though. They would use their trebuchets to lay siege on a city, and then they would project these gunpowder balls into the air that would land on the castle or the city or the fortress and then explode. So that has a true devastating effect that the Mongolians will capitalize on. However, the Mongolians aren't going to last very long where they're incorporating this in the Golden Horde. So as the Golden Horde declines in the 1400s, you see Europeans regaining control and diffusing the concept of the gunpowder. So gunpowder will then be used in European societies where innovation in the 1400s is on the rise in Europe. However, the Ottoman empires are the first ones to really be the first gunpowder empire. So Ottoman Turks will incorporate the use of gunpowder for their sieges and some of their battle campaigns, especially out in the Mediterranean Sea. And they'll develop the harquebus, or a gun that they can shoot. It's not hugely effective, but it's the beginning of what can end feudalism. And we'll get back to that later. Probably the most prominent feature that is exchanged back and forth is really the disease. And as you've seen in the news lately, disease is still one of our big threats in global society. So back then, the bubonic plague will spread along mainly the Silk Routes and on ships that, you know, when you have a ship that can dock in Guangzhou, China, and travel all the way back to Lisbon, Portugal, on that ship are going to be your rats that are hosting the fleas that carry the bubonic plague. And then so you have Chinese people that get diseased, and you have Europeans get diseased, but also the middleman traders of the Arab traders of the Middle East. We don't really have record recordings of how many people died in the Middle East, but it probably, like China and Europe, was about 20% of the population. So Europe and China are also going to go into an economic decline or economic contraction due to depopulation of the territory, And that will run its course over about a 100-year period, that once the bubonic plague has run its course, you then see a regrowth, rebirth, and reorganization of China and Europe. So the Ming Dynasty. Really what's left behind here is the Mongolians have been ousted out of China. They've left a legacy of well-developed and safeguarded trade routes. Mongolians are probably better known as trade facilitators rather than village destroyers. It's not as fun to talk about them as trade facilitators though, so you don't hear that side. So they do leave a legacy of well-developed trade routes that the Ming Dynasty will capitalize on and then re-Chinasize China, so to speak. So the leader of this will be Hong Wu, which his first initiative is to increase the Confucian value system of China. He will reinvigorate the civil service exam. Now, the Mongolians at first collapsed the Confucian system, although over time started to accept Buddhism and therefore Neo-Confucianism. So that is somewhat still there, but the Mongolians did destroy the civil service exam because it was a threat to their administrative techniques. So Hong Wu is going to reincorporate with vigor the civil service exam, and you'll be putting administrators in place in government positions who are highly educated and have great skills to do it. Sometimes, especially in a nomadic society, you put people in place who sometimes are either hereditary or maybe they won their position through battle. That doesn't mean that they're a good administrator. And especially if you have nepotism where you're hiring your family members into positions in their government, they could be poorly skilled workers, and therefore you start to see the decline and the degradation of your political system. So the civil service exam is a massive gluing compound for Chinese society and political environment. Two approaches to this is the development of mandarins and eunuchs. Mandarins will be ethnic development of scholars. So mandarins are an actual particular population of the Chinese society that will value education, and they will become the academic scholars for government administration and emperors. However, the imperial court will be controlled by eunuchs, because eunuchs hold no threat to an emperor, because they, we've talked about eunuchs before, and I don't think we need to go into all that. So therefore, what you do is you have two entities that help you control your high-level policies and political government through the mandarin scholars and the eunuchs. Those two will, in essence, pit each other's power against each other, which prevents either one from taking over and, in essence, safeguarding the emperor. These two will go to war at certain times. So then, as you start to rebuild Chinese society, you have the rebuilding of the irrigation system that improves agricultural techniques, that supports your population, and you once again reinvigorate manufacturing. China, historically, has been a manufacturer. They did so through the silk industry and the porcelain industry all the way back to 500 BC. So they're manufacturers with a large population that can serve as a labor force. Europe has never had that. That is why Europe was going through a period of dark ages of strict, slow feudalism that eventually Europe will pull out of, particularly with the manufacturing prowess of the textile workers in Flanders. But China has a history of this and are much more inundated with the manufacturing system. So now the re-Sinicization of China. Yang Li is going to go on his escapade, so to speak, to enforce Chinese cultural values to make sure people become, well, Chinese again. So they will expel Mongolian values and traditions and cultural entities and replace it with traditional Chinese items. And one of the examples he does is the Yongli Encyclopedia. The intent here is to create a book that has all the ideas and histories of Chinese culture and mass produce it through the printing system so that everyone can read it and understand Chinese culture. Now, it is difficult to print that thing, and mass production may not be a success, but it does get printed, and it is an entity within Chinese culture that does help people re-Sinicize China. So now Europe. Europe is in a different situation. They didn't have the overbearing control by the Mongolians. They basically have multiple divided kingdoms that have not united. But those kingdoms will compete with each other, especially for business. Therefore, that will motivate trade. As trade increases, you can tax those people. When you increase your taxation, then kings can use that money to raise large standing armies, and those armies can suppress local authorities or lords. So the taxation develops standing armies where emperors begin to build city-states. This is particularly important in Italy, that although Italy itself isn't one big country, the city-states within Italy become magnificently powerful. And this will come to true eminence during the Renaissance, as multiple city-states fight for intellectual power. But an example of this is Niccolo Machiavelli, who writes the book The Prince, that talks about power, hiring mercenaries or standing armies, you know, keep your enemies close to you so you can keep them under watch, and keep your allies at a distance so they don't get too used to you. Those are all those Machiavellian principles that you see in Sun Tzu's Art of War and stuff. But that's that time frame. And what really epitomizes the development of countries back then is the Hundred Years' War that will create the identity for England and France. As you know, William the Conqueror crossed the English Channel and conquered territories in southern England. However, he never gave up his rights to the land in Normandy. And Normandy and into Belgium is the Flanders region of a highly productive woolen textile trade. So my personal standpoint is that the Hundred Years' War is motivated by economic purposes or trade. Many people would think that this is more of a political deal, because William the Conqueror doesn't want to give up his land and he wants to enforce his political system on France, which really hasn't developed as a country yet. So the Hundred Years' War, which lasts from about 1350 to 1450, you know, 100 years, is going to cause these two to begin to unite under a banner or a flag, and that's nationalism. Like the United States has the flag. We follow that banner here in the United States. We rally underneath that. Europe, England and France particularly, are just now beginning to do that, and linguistic barriers help do that. England is probably more united at the time. France still has multiple princedoms, and you can imagine, if you have seven princes, which prince is going to volunteer to charge into battle first, then get decimated, leaving the rest of the battle to the princes who didn't charge into battle? So you can see that this disunity in France prevents them from moving as one big solid force. So the Hundred Years' War is epitomized by the English winning every battle except for the final battle, where the French finally do win, and what some people believe, Joan of Arc unites the French into one French culture, French flag. So I'd like to argue that really an entity, England won this war. They might ultimately have to give up Flanders, and then England will become England and France will become France, but England won every battle until the last one. But the true essence here is that the Hundred Years' War, because of the English, will end feudalism. One reason is because of the English longbow versus the French crossbow. When I say crossbow, I don't just mean guys who have a crossbow, but it's also the knights who have heavy armor and sit on top of horses. Knights and shining armor on horses are very expensive, and that is the feudal way to fight war. England is coming to France with a peasant army of massive numbers of peasants who don't just hold a spear anymore. They have longbows because they grow up hunting in the countryside of England. Longbows can shoot about 1,000 meters. Crossbows shoot about 100 meters. If you could do the math there, you would understand that the English longbow will massacre knights in shining armor and peasant crossbow holders from a safe distance. So much smaller English armies are going to destroy large feudal French armies, and it will bring the end to knights in shining armor. And then that'll end feudalism, and ultimately England will pull out, France will become France, and England will become England. The next thing is direct taxation. See, before, lords or local authorities taxed their people, and with that money, each little manor or Camelot or princedom, if you will, can do what they want with that money. Kings had to rely on the lords giving them support. This is going to change now, because now the king can directly tax the people, especially when you break down feudalism. When a king can direct tax, he uses that money to build large standing armies. An example of this will be the Reconquista of France. As the House of Aragon and Castile unite in a marriage alliance between Ferdinand and Isabella, they will have also an ability to tax the people, raising large armies and attacking Muslim Moors and pushing out Jews out of Spain. So this is development of what you think of Spain as today. And the Reconquista will follow through in the 1400s and in essence finish in 1492, which is also the same time frame that Christopher Columbus is going to be commissioned to go across the Atlantic Ocean. If you ever watch, there's a movie out there of Christopher Columbus' travels. When he gets hired by the Spanish to do his trip, it's really interesting, because Christopher Columbus, I don't know if you know this, he's not Spanish. He's Genoese. The Genoese were in direct conflict with the Venice traders. Matter of fact, Genoa and Venice are probably, their little war is probably what brought down Constantinople, because if you remember, the Fourth Crusade sacks Constantinople. And the reason why is because the Genoese and the Venetians talked the Crusaders into doing that so they could plunder the wealth of Constantinople, because the two were competing commercially. So when Spain is going out on the ocean, you have to understand that Portugal was really the first ones out on the ocean. They didn't go across the Atlantic Ocean yet, but they were definitely out in the Atlantic discovering the Canary Islands, the Azores, Sao Tome, and they're going to be bouncing around the west coast of Africa. And this is a threat, because if the Portuguese Catholics discover the world, Spanish Catholics will then, in essence, bow to the Portuguese. So if you can see, once again, city-states or small kings are in Europe are going to compete against each other. And an example of this is the Spanish Catholics and the Portuguese Catholics. In essence, the Pope will eventually have to step in and separate them, because they're like two little kids fighting. So they'll commission Christopher Columbus. He'll go out over the ocean in 1492 and he'll discover the Americas. So the race is on. Okay, so let's continue on, because we're not really getting into exploration today. So let's go on back to Europe in the 1400s. So everything I've just been talking about is culminating with the Renaissance. Now, when you read the book on the Renaissance, by the way, I need to add these notes to the notes I have on Blackboard, because these aren't on that page on Blackboard. So I'll add these and repost them unless you guys write them down today. But I don't want you to have to know any names from the Renaissance. Your book probably has 10 names, like Michelangelo and Donatello and Da Vinci. So I'm not going to make you memorize those names and what they did. Here's the important thing to know, is that humanism is the profound element that is created from the Renaissance. Now, yes, the painters, the sculptors, the architects, that is what identifies the Renaissance. And there's no reason to make any sculptures or paintings unless there's humanism. Humanism, in essence, is placing value on individual effort. In essence, that's an anti-Christian thing. In feudal Catholic Europe, individual achievement is not good. It's like anti-Catholic. You need to move forward in society as a group. So usually Christians, that's why making a profit in Christianity was considered bad, because you're improving yourself. But when humanism comes along, and by the way, the reason why they discover humanism is because it's the Renaissance, it's the rebirth, it's the rediscovering of ancient classics such as Roman and Greek classics. And it is Cicero, back in Greek time frame, that writes about humanism and individual value that a human being can do great stuff in his society and still be a strong Christian, so to speak. And so when Christians refine this, so to speak, it's okay to make a profit. They get over the concept of usury, where they couldn't make interest rates off money, which is why Jewish bankers were able to powerfully control the banking industry in Europe up until that time frame. Or at least some people still argue the Jews still do, but Christians do have strong banking mechanisms today. So humanism starts with the emotion in the painting. You have to understand there is no emotion up to this time frame. When you look at paintings or sculptures, the figures are more just stoic and straight. But now, they're going to have emotion. I forget if it's Michelangelo or Donatello that does the sculptures where the human bodies actually that they sculpt look like actual human bodies with symmetrical muscle and skeletal figures. And they might be standing looking cool rather than just straightforward, like Charlemagne. If you look at Charlemagne's statue, he's like this. Whereas Michelangelo's guys, when they make those guys like this, and they're looking up at the sky and they're throwing a disc. And so that's the resurfacing of the classics. And then that's put into this concept of how Christians can interact with their public. They can be a public figure and, in a way, privately in their house, a strong Christian. And that starts to increase trade in Europe. And it's what allows corporations who can make a profit to develop. Okay, so where are we at here? Marriage, businesses, public affairs, reconcile Christianity with the urban and commercial concepts. Okay, I think we're good with humanism in Europe. Let me talk about... let's see here. Let's go ahead and talk about Zhangbao. We're going to talk about some of these early travelers, explorers. Zhangha and Henry the Navigator. China's pretty interesting. You do realize that they're a Confucian value system. They would never really want to go out on the world and discover stuff because they're Confucian. They believe in internal introspection. The problem is the Mongolians weren't necessarily Confucian. Had some Buddhismism, they accepted Islam, and Islam does support trade and exploration. So some Chinese dudes are Muslim. Zhangha is an example of that. So he's the legacy carried on by the Mongolians, who is not only a Muslim, but he's also a eunuch. So in essence, he's void from being embroiled in political affairs. So he's going to do stuff for the emperor, which is interesting. You realize the first Chinese emperors after Mongols are Confucians. So he's doing this as a Muslim and an explorer for Confucian emperors. Now his ships, I don't know if you know this, his ships are like 6 times bigger than Christopher Columbus. His treasure fleets have over 300 ships in them. So when they're moving throughout the Indian Ocean, the South China Sea, this is a massive maneuvering. They don't worry about pirates. See, when you have 300 ships, 50 of them are probably battleships. So they don't worry about pirates. Europeans were always worried about pirates. Because like Christopher Columbus took 3 ships with him, and they were small. They're worried about pirates because they're weak. Zhang Haz is too powerful, so they just plow through the waters wherever they want, through the South China Sea, Sea of Bengal, and the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean. And they'll go as far as Africa, and I think he brings back like giraffe and tigers and stuff to the Chinese court, and the Chinese are mesmerized, because you realize they've been insular, right? So this is amazing to them, because they've never seen this stuff. The problem is, over time, it is believed the Confucian guys start getting a little scared about this exploration, and they will recall Zhang He. They will sink all of his ships, burn all documents about exploration, and kill all the sailors. So they outlaw the ability to ever build ships. So they completely disintegrate exploration, and they lose their legacy to even build ships, which is why, in a couple hundred more years, the British, in essence, take over China. And the Chinese they don't even know how to build ships anymore. That's a little bit on Zhang He. You can see his time frame there. And that's, if you remember, I've shown you that book before, 1423, the year that China discovered America. Have I shown that to you? I'll show it to you once I pull this microphone out of my gut. I hope this is working because I haven't checked it. Okay, with the Portuguese, you got Henry the Navigator, Prince Henry, Henry Henrique, whatever his name is. He's Portuguese. I don't know if you know this, but Portugal is on the Atlantic Ocean. There's nowhere for Portuguese to go other than, well, the Atlantic Ocean. So they're going to be out there discovering Atlantic Ocean stuff. Now, I admit, he's in the Mediterranean. He's going to battle over the Straits of Gibraltar because, as you know, Muslim forces have controlled the Straits of Gibraltar. Christian ships aren't going to be bouncing out into the Atlantic Ocean. So he's going to fight Moroccan, Berber, Moor, Muslim forces to retake Qatar. This is the first place he takes over. From there, they'll be able to expand out into the Atlantic. They're going to discover the Canary Islands, the Azores, the Madeiras Islands, Sao Tome, and all those. These are small islands. They're basically free land. And on that free land, you can grow sugar cane. Now, sugar cane hasn't totally came over yet, but it is on its way. And when the British start bringing tea back from China, by the way, tea isn't good unless you put sugar in it, according to the masses of people. So once the British are drinking tea and then they incorporate sugar with it, the demand for sugar is so massive that they will transplant sugarcane from mainly the Arab traders. The Arabs already have it. They got it in Palestine and into Cyprus and some of those islands out into the Mediterranean Sea. They will steal it from there and transplant it in the Azores, Madeiras, Sao Tome, and Canary Islands. And so the Europeans will start making sugar. The only problem is Europeans don't have the agricultural know-how. And you realize they're all like wheat farmers from Germany. So they're going to get their workers from Africa. So they'll move black slaves from Africa to those islands, and they will cultivate the sugar cane, which will provide the demand for sugar that incorporates itself with tea in Britain and Europe. This is why my platform in world history is that trade drives political, social, and economic foundations. So here's what Henry the Navigator does. I've already told you the early stuff. But more importantly, he's going to build a school, a navigation school. He's going to bring ship captains together, ship builders together, sailors, and map makers. Imagine a school with all these guys coming together under one roof that can sit around and talk and study the world. Do you think they'll discover how to sail across an ocean with a magnetic compass, how to use the stars, I don't know if you know this, they're going to invent sails that go against the wind. They can travel against the wind. They have to tack back and forth. It's not very efficient. But if you're tacking back and forth and you're moving forward 1 mile an hour, but the current is going 20 miles an hour, you are going to get someplace by using the currents, even though you're, in essence, working against the wind. So So they discover current patterns out in the ocean, plus working against the wind using a magnetic compass. You will never discover the Canary Islands unless you get away from land. And back then, they were scared to, you know, go out on the ocean and you can't see land. That's weird, because you don't know where you're at. But by using the stars and magnetic compass, they're able to venture out and they'll discover those islands, which then supports the sugar trade and the exploitation I just talked to you about. So, the follow-on forces of Henry the Navigator is Vasco da Gama. Although Bartholomew Diaz is already going to go around the southern tip of Cape Hope, he gets scared. When he goes down around South Africa, he gets over into the Indian Ocean, he gets scared. It's scary stuff, they don't know what's over, so he comes back. But he tells people, so they know it can be done. They knew there was probably an end point to Africa, they just didn't know where. They've been bouncing around that coastline of Africa, but now they've bounced and bounced over to the other side. So the follow-on forces to this is going to be Vasco da Gama. And when you look at the years, you do realize it's like 7 or 5 years after Christopher Columbus. So the Portuguese are in a battle to race the Spanish to find the New World. I mean, they know it's there, but the Portuguese think you can go the other direction to get to it faster. So when Vasco da Gama rounds the southern tip of Cape Hope, he also is going to be circumventing the Arab middleman traders of the Middle East. Because the Middle East controls all that trade back and forth. But if you go around them, you never have to trade with them anymore. So when Vasco da Gama goes to India and starts trading with pepper and spices, he just takes it straight to Lisbon. They eliminate not only the Arab middleman, they eliminate Venice and Genoa. And so Italy will also see an economic contraction. Spain and Portugal become global powers. Otherwise, I don't know if you've ever heard this term, most African Americans speak Portuguese. Are you unaware that 80% of all slaves went to Brazil, where they speak Portuguese? Most African Americans speak Portuguese. About 13% of African slaves came to the United States. Another 7%, 10%, whatever, were going to the Cuba, Haiti, Dominican Republic, you know, those islands. So, where was I with this? Vasco da Gama, collapse of Italy, the proliferation of Portugal, Spain were at a spot that they could have controlled the world. Their religious fervor against each other will crumble them, and their monarchs will crumble them. England, who will take over after this, isn't absolute monarchs like Spain is. So that's why England will take over, and it can be argued, still control the world to this day. Peter just shut off.